Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View podcast. I have a great guest for you that I really hope you like, focusing on our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Dan McCaleb. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee, and please subscribe. It is absolutely free, but for some reason, I don't know why, the algorithms that keep us at the top go by subscribers. And thank you for listening. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Dan McCaleb. The Center Square was launched in May 2019 to fulfill the need for high-quality statehouse and statewide news across the United States. The focus of their work is state and local level government and economic reporting. A taxpayer sensibility distinguishes its work from other coverage of state and local issues. As a result of this approach, their readers are better informed about the focus of state and local government and its cost to the citizens when tax dollars fund governmental decisions. The Center Square is staffed by editors and reporters with extensive professional journalism experience who engage readers with essential news, data, and analysis delivered with velocity, frequency, and consistency. They distribute journalism through three main channels at no cost to our partners or readers: a newswire service to legacy publishers and broadcasters, thecentersquare.com, and social media. The Center Square is a project of the 501c3 Franklin News Foundation, headquartered in Chicago. Dan McCaleb is a veteran editor and has worked in journalism for more than 25 years. Most recently, McCaleb served as editorial director of Shaw Media and the top editor of the award-winning Northwest Herald in suburban Chicago. Now executive editor at thecentersquare.com and Franklin News Foundation. Husband, father, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Tom Waits, music fan, Cleveland area sports fan. Hello, Dan. Thank you for coming on with us.
Hey, how Steve. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You and I sat down at a coffee shop one-on-one about a year ago today, and so it's nice to be able to spread your word to my listeners. Tell us about Center Square and all it does.
Yeah, so the Center Square, as you mentioned, it's a newswire service. Our main focus is covering state governments in all 50 states, including in Tennessee and the state of Washington and Illinois, where I'm located at, and in all 50 states. We also have a bureau in Washington, D.C., where we cover the federal government. And essentially, the Center Square was launched in an age where media has been rapidly changing, right? Newspapers, which had been for decades the main source of local folks, is news. Pick up their local newspaper, either delivered to their home or at the local deli or 7-Eleven or whatever. But they've been in decline for a number of years. Advertising dollars have largely gone from newspapers to online giants like Google and Facebook, etc. So newspapers across the country because they've lost significant amounts of revenue over the years, they've had to cut back on staffs and journalists. And one of the first things that we noticed journalists that were losing their jobs were journalists that covered state governments, journalists who were in state capitals, paying attention to their legislatures, their governors, et cetera. And that void kept growing year in and year out. And so the founders of the precursor of the Center Square, launched in Illinois back in the days when we were known as Illinois News Network, they saw, if you're not familiar with Illinois politics, we have a few former governors who have served significant jail time.
I do want to get into that as we stray a little bit away from Center Square and then come back to Center Square. But yeah, okay. Go ahead.
I'll hold that for later. But essentially, Illinois government has been so bad for so long. How much worse was it going to get if there were no journalists paying attention to what was going on?
A lot worse
in the state capitol. So the brilliant founders of what became the Center Square noticed this huge gap in state government reporting and decided to create a nonprofit to raise money against a mission to cover the Illinois state government, and to share that content at no cost to media outlets that used to be able to cover state government, but because of the changing media landscape, we're no longer able to do so, to share our stories with those newspapers for their websites, for their print products, et cetera. And it was a huge success. So what was, we decided in 2018, early 2019, to take the success we were having in Illinois to other states across the country. And we eventually grew to all 50 states.
Awesome. Yep. And that's how I got to know you, because you make my content all the better in the state of Washington, all the way over there in Illinois. So you are in Illinois. I do want to stray a little bit from the business stuff and just talk general Chicago stuff, because not a lot of people here in Tennessee know or care what's going on there, but it's interesting. You wrote an article for the News Gazette in 2018, way back when. Taxpayers need to know the full story as the graduated income tax debate continues. A fair income tax will affect workers in all brackets. Should those who make more money pay a higher percentage of their wages in state income taxes than others who make less? Good question. That was 5 years ago. Should they? Uh-oh, we lost your sound. There you are.
I'm back. I'm sorry. Well, in my personal opinion, I did write opinion in the past, but my personal opinion, no, particularly in a state like Illinois, which already Illinois taxpayers already pay among the highest taxes in the country. Property taxes are second highest only to New Jersey. We do have income tax, a state income tax here. I know you in Tennessee, you folks don't have a state income tax there. But everything from gas taxes to sales taxes to everything, it's really outrageous here in Illinois. And what we've noticed, this is even before this this progressive income tax thing came up, is that for the nine consecutive years, dating before the 2018 column that you just referenced, all the way up until today, nine consecutive years, Illinois has lost population. People yep. are fleeing the state of Illinois. And guess where they're going? They're Tennessee. Going to no income tax states like Tennessee and Florida and Texas. It was my personal opinion. We generally just do news, but it was my personal opinion that would only changing the state's income tax from a flat tax to a progressive tax would only speed up the flight from Illinois. And while voters soundly rejected changing the state's constitution to allow for a progressive income tax, they rejected it at the ballot box in 2020. We're still seeing year after year of out migration from Illinois to other lower tax states. So there is talk in Springfield, Illinois state capital, of putting the matter before voters again at some point in the future. We'll see what happens.
So not only is the state of Illinois interesting, but the city of Chicago and corruption are synonymous. Chicago City Hall's Alderman Daniel Solis, Alderman Edward Burke, and Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, an FBI agent interpreted the conversation this way. I understand Solis to mean that by hiring Madigan's private firm, the developer, would ensure that Solis and Madigan would take official action benefiting the developer in their capacity as public officials. It was the feds who brought down corrupt former governor Rod Blago, however you say it, Blago.
Madigan, Blagojevich, yeah.
Blagojevich, okay, Blagojevich.
Get that one down.
With a name like Abramowitz. Madigan was indicted by a grand jury Wednesday on 22 federal charges related to racketeering, bribery, and attempted extortion. What is up with Chicago?
Oh man, it's Chicago machine style politics. As a matter of fact, we just wrote a story at thecentersquare.com today. Michael Madigan was a Chicago Democrat, part of the Chicago political machine. He was Speaker of the Illinois House for nearly 40 years, 38 years. Madigan reigned over the House reigned over the state legislature as House Speaker. For more than 20 of those years, he was also the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party. So he had really two two powerful positions. He controlled the campaign money that was coming into the state Democratic Party, so he could control Democrats because he would decide who would get that money when they're running for office. And he controlled legislation that went that would go through the House. And if he didn't like certain legislation, he blocked it. So this 9-year FBI investigation into Madigan and the entire Chicago political machine investigation, they claim or they allege that Michael Madigan used his powerful positions to essentially receive bribes from powerful players like ComEd, which is the biggest utility company in Illinois. ComEd actually admitted in a pre-prosecution deal with federal prosecutors, that it paid Madigan and Madigan's people close to Madigan no show up jobs that really didn't exist, but they'd pay them. And Madigan last year, and you mentioned a number of Chicago aldermen, that all three of the people you named specifically are currently under federal indictment and facing prosecution. And I was telling you about the story that we published at thecentersquare.com today. Some of those officials who are close to Madigan go on trial starting in April. A couple of ComEd officials, Michael McLean, who was Madigan's right-hand man while he was running Illinois House. He's no longer the speaker. After all this stuff started coming out, he really was forced to resign. But Madigan will go on trial next year. But his alleged accomplices go on trial in April, and we'll certainly be covering that heavily at thecentersquare.com.
It really is amazing. I mean, it was a joke that they served one term as governor and one term in prison, but it's become a reality. And you would think that anyone who was there 40 years probably could have been caught 30, 35, 39 years earlier, because you got to be corrupt.
Here's the other thing about the Madigan machine. Michael Madigan, as we just talked about, is the longtime former speaker. His daughter, Lisa Madigan, was the state attorney general for 16 years. And of course, the state attorney general's office is the top law enforcement office in the state. Charged was supposed to be, investigating alleged corruption in government. But when it's a father and daughter, you know, what are you going to do?
Biden and Merrick Garland could only hope for such connections. So a new report was found that Illinois has 60 public schools at which zero students reported grade level proficiency in either reading or math. I thought Baltimore was bad. That's worse. In a troubling sign for the state's education system across the Prairie State, there are 23 schools, including 18 in Chicago, where no student demonstrated proficiency in either subject in 2022, according to analysis of state data by WirePoints. Another 7 Illinois schools had zero proficiency in reading alone, and 30 had no students with proficiency in math alone, the study found. Wow. Going to school, not helping much, are they?
It's really sad. And you mentioned the Chicago schools. And I mentioned earlier, too, that Illinois residents pay the second highest property taxes in the country. So it's not a lack of funding for the schools. In fact, in Chicago public schools, taxpayers pay $30,000 per student to educate those children. And those the outcomes you just read there, that's the result of pouring so much money into the school system, yet it failing. We're talking about a lot of low income students from poor minority communities. The system has just completely failed them. Chicago teachers unions have gained so much power and influence over both local government and state government over the years. Illinois is not does not have much in the way of school choice. So families whether it's low income or medium income or whatever income, if their local school, if their local public school is failing their child, there's very little a parent can do about it.
Wow. You also covered trial attorneys who exploit Illinois' very liberal judicial system to enrich themselves by winning huge monetary verdicts or settlements for their clients in civil cases, and how that jacks up prices on all things. That was in 2018, just like the op-ed I read earlier. Has it gotten better or worse?
It has not gotten better, I assure you of that. In fact, there's a national tort reform group that every year puts out what it calls its judicial hell holes. And Illinois' court system is always among the top five or six judicial hell holes across the country. And it's because of these outrageous jury verdicts. Essentially, state government, you know, allows trial attorneys to file almost any type of case. We just had a verdict within the past week or so. Illinois has a biometric privacy law. These have been popping up around the country, and there's nothing wrong with the biometric privacy laws. If you like post a photo on Facebook, Facebook is supposed to get your permission. For example, if it wants to use your image in marketing or something else like that, or to steal your facial recognition identity or use that. A restaurant chain had been having employees log into work by using their fingerprint. And that is in violation of Illinois' biometric privacy law. And they went to trial, and the court essentially said, the Supreme Court, this went all the way to the Supreme Court, said that they can be fined for every single instance of every single individual every time they had to give their fingerprint or had to sign in or log into work using their fingerprint. And if it's, you know, one employee signs in 5 days a week, it's a $1,000 fine. So that one employee could cost that business $5,000 for just coming to work for 1 week. You add that up, all the employees over more than a year's time, they're facing $1 billion in fines. Jeez. And that's why Illinois is often, small businesses have been complaining since I've been in Illinois about the legal climate here. We pay among the highest workers' compensation rate. Small businesses pay among the highest workers' compensation rates in the country, and it's because of things like that.
Yeah, and Boeing, for some reason, left Washington State for Illinois just for some breaks, but I wonder if it was a good deal or not. You know, your governor, J.D. Pritzker, he did away with cash bail on January 1st of this year. Since we've got 2 months now almost under our belt, has that been good for reducing crime and protecting victims, or good for criminals?
Okay, so it was supposed to go into effect January 1st. There are several lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of the cashless bail provision. On December 31st, as a matter of fact, I remember it was New Year's Eve. I'm at home with my wife, getting ready to celebrate New Year's Eve. I get a call from my Illinois reporter who says, hey, the Illinois Supreme Court just blocked that law from going into effect. So it's not in effect yet. Thankfully, essentially, there's 102 counties in the state of Illinois. So 102 state's attorneys, district attorneys, you know, each state calls them a little different, something different. In Illinois, there's state's attorneys. 100 of the 102 state's attorneys across Illinois opposed this law, and dozens of them filed suit to block it. So right now it's in the Illinois Supreme Court's hands. It has not gone into effect. Their concern, the state's attorney's concern, is that, and this was across the board cashless bail. This isn't like, you know, you're caught with some marijuana or a little bit of marijuana or something like that. You don't have to post bail to get out of jail before you go to trial. This was violent offenses included. And the state's attorneys were worried that they were going to, one, have to empty their jails of people who are already in jail awaiting trial on certain crimes, violent crimes, etc. And two, that it was just going to lead to more crimes being committed in their communities by violent offenders.
Almost by design. His brother, sister, Jennifer, born James Nicholas Pritzker, is the richest transgender person in America and a colonel in the Illinois Army National Guard. He, she gives millions to transgender surgery hospitals and donated $101,000 in additional six-figure future support to the ACLU from her Tawani Foundation to fight Tennessee's anti-transgender laws in court. How powerful a force is she?
I honestly don't know much that much about her, but the Pritzker family itself, they're all billionaires. They're essentially descendants of the Hyatt Hotel chain, so they inherited their money. They're all billionaires. Governor Pritzker himself, just in this last election cycle, donated millions and millions of dollars to Democratic governors across the state. So to answer, go back to your original question, they're all powerful, and they all have all the money in the world. Pritzker self-financed his own campaign. He's a second-term governor. He won re-election in November. He, over the two campaigns, he gave himself more than $200 million to run for office, to win the governor's office. So yes, they're powerful.
Wow. And not big in Republican politics. So we know what issues they're pushing. In Tennessee, you have John Stiff. Is that how you say his name?
Stiff. That's correct. John Stiff.
Covering a lot of our state news in your website's Southeast section. I see a lot of it picked up now and again on TennesseeConservative.news.com. And in Washington, I use Brett Davis myself all the time in The View. Tell us about those two.
Yeah, so let's start with John Stiff, who covers Tennessee state government for us. John and I actually worked together back in our old newspaper days. A very good reporter. He was an editor of a daily newspaper for a number of years. When I learned that he might be looking become available, I jumped at the opportunity to get him. He's very, very good reporter. One of the things he's been really kicking it on is the Tennessee Titans stadium deal there in Nashville. Taxpayers funding stadiums has been going on for decades. The Titans wanted a new stadium. Nashville, many people in Nashville wanted them to build a new stadium in the city. The Titans, of course, came with their hands out, wanting taxpayers to fund at least a portion of it. The Titans put out economic projections. The Metro Nashville area put out their economic projections, and John Stiff pushed back against those projections. You know, here's how many jobs we're going to create. Here's how much money is going to come to the community if we build this new stadium for the Titans. But John just didn't take what the Titans spoon fed them, what local officials spoon fed them. He went out and he got answers from elsewhere, and he found that those numbers that they put out are just way, way inflated.
Yep. I credit him with the pushback that the stadium is now on pause, as a matter of fact, and also because the community was not going to benefit it hardly at all.
Yeah, other media in the state just essentially reprinted press releases from the Titans and whatnot. John pushed back, and he really changed the narrative in the media there, because others had to start following suit.
And Brett has had that power too.
Brett Davis, yes, in Washington. He covers state government for us in Washington. One thing I want to note, you pointed early on about the Center Square. We approach news with, we want to explain to taxpayers how governments, in this case, mostly state governments, but Nashville, we covered the issue in Nashville, which is more local, how governments spend your tax dollars and how well they spend your tax dollars, how efficient it is. And Brett in Washington State gets that. Of course, Washington, a blue state with a Democratic-controlled legislature, a Democratic governor. They've got not income tax. Help me out here, Steve.
They want to do this asset tax, a net worth tax. Yeah.
Right. And Brett's been following that closely.
But they won't call it a tax. That's why they.
Right. That's right. Because it would be unconstitutional, right? Washington's constitution prohibits it. But he's been following it through the courts. And he does a great job for us in Washington State.
He does. Are you able to speak about McCaleb versus Long?
Is that's the court case in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So let me just tell everybody. So your First Amendment.
I can summarize. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. So your First Amendment right, civil action in Tennessee against Michelle Long, director of the Tennessee Administrative Office of the Courts, preventing you from assigning reporters, like we just talked about, to cover Tennessee judicial conference meetings here in Middle Tennessee. Outrageous.
So briefly, essentially it's an association of Tennessee judges that meet a couple times, in some instances, three times a year, where they discuss judicial matters, including policy matters, and they make decisions at these meetings. At least we think we do, but we don't know for sure because we've been prevented from covering it. And our case, we filed the case because we think Tennessee taxpayers, Tennessee residents have a right to know what's going on at these meetings, just like they have a right to go to the state legislature and witness the House or the Senate debate policy issues. It's our feeling that we also should have a right to follow these policy discussions when it comes to the court system in Tennessee. So that case is still pending. I probably said more than my attorneys would have wanted me to say, but
it is
what it is, right?
We also have this strange system here in Tennessee where the Senate records their votes, yay or nay. The Assembly does not. And so it's all voice votes. And we've had an instance where somebody would say yay on a bill because of voice vote. And then a legislature will walk up and say, please record me as a no, so I don't have to go back to my constituents and explain that I voted yes. We are trying really hard to make that change so that they have to apply like the Senate versus the Senate have to act like the Assembly and not do that as well. Do you have other fights like that on your hands in other states too?
That is my only pending court case where I am a plaintiff in the case, but we have in the past in Illinois, for example, the Center Square is blocked from getting House and Senate credentials. We've taken both the Illinois and the House and the Senate in the past to court over that. Unfortunately, we lost because the court system here is sometimes it feels like it's rigged as well. But we're constantly fighting state and local governments for information. We file Freedom of Information Act requests all the time. Oftentimes we get denied. We get lawyers involved. When that happens, if we think it should absolutely be public knowledge, public record, et cetera. So we get in those kinds of disputes fairly regularly.
I had to do that myself in a little tiny city just to see if somebody was lying and saying I did not meet with somebody to end up giving them their endorsement, even though they did. And it was all on email, and that's where FOIA comes in. So editor to editor, let's chat a little bit about the industry. Less than a year after many celebrated the disbanding of the Biden administration's disinformation board, remember that? It appears that the administration has been funding a British group to rank sites to warn people about high-risk disinformation sites. Gabe Kaminsky at the Washington Examiner previously ran a story on the index. The Global Disinformation Index, GDI, has released its index, and every one of the high-risk sites turned out to be, wait for it, conservative or libertarian sites. You know about this?
I am familiar with this. In fact, we wrote a story about it today, I think it was. Unfortunately, what we're learning about the Biden administration and its essentially partnerships with some of these media outlets, social media outlets. We've written about the Twitter files. You're familiar with the Twitter files?
Oh, yeah.
Ever since Elon Musk bought Twitter, he has been releasing information. COVID-19, of course, is really where this snowball started rolling downhill, where the federal government under the Biden administration would seek to squash information it didn't like. We know now, 3 years after COVID, we know now that generally remote learning was an absolute failure, right? There's really no disputing that. We know that mask mandates didn't work all that well. We know that vaccine mandates didn't work all that well. But in the moment when we were still in, the pandemic, even though there were people saying this, and it turned out to be true, government didn't want people saying this. So they partnered with Facebook and with Twitter and with other social media giants to squash what they deemed at the time misinformation that we now know is not misinformation. Of course, you've got Hunter Biden's laptop. It's a completely separate issue. President Biden's son and the laptop that the New York Post got their hands on and reported on just before the 2020 election, that was deemed misinformation by the mainstream media, by social media outlets. And that story was squashed until after the election. And yeah. We now know it was not misinformation. So it's really scary stuff.
Yeah, it's straight up censorship, straight up repression. And then they had to default to outside of the country, a British company, instead of using an American company that was subject to the new Republican Congress and their information. Now, you wrote in The Lion, a Herzog Foundation publication, that in Florida, after reviewing 132 textbooks, that the Florida Department of Education found 54 of them, 41%, were in violation of the state's standards. Critical race theory, inclusion of Common Core, and the unsolicited addition of social emotional learning in mathematics. Those same books are being purchased for $2 million in just this county in Tennessee, Williamson. Let me just run down this list real quick. 78 of 132 total submitted textbooks are being included on the state's adopted list. This is from your report about Florida. 21% are not included on the adopted list because they incorporated prohibited topics or unsolicited strategies, including CRT. 9% are not included on the adopted list because they do not properly align to BEST standards. 11% are not included on the adopted list because they do not properly align to best standards and incorporate prohibited topics or unsolicited strategies, including CRT. Grades K through 5, 71% of materials were rejected. Grades 6 through 8, 20% of materials were rejected. Grades 9 through 12, 35% of materials were rejected. What is up with the textbooks, and what is this all? Penguin Classics, or are there other big publishers behind these rejected materials?
I don't want to speak for you, but I will, I guess, maybe. I don't know. When you and I went to school, Steve, I know it was like this for me. You know, you learned how to read, how to write. You learned mathematics. That was a big topic. Science was a big topic. Of course, history and geography and things like that. Now, all the social stuff, I never even dreamed that all the social stuff would show up in school curriculums across the country. But that Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, who many consider a potential presidential candidate in 2024, when he got into office, he and the Republican legislature decided that schools were supposed to be about learning the basics, learning mathematics, learning how to read and write, learning, of course, with STEM nowadays, with the digital world we live in, to prepare students for careers in STEM, in STEM-type careers, et cetera. That's what school was supposed to be about. And all the social stuff didn't belong in school. So the governor, with the legislature's help, started banning things like critical race theory. You've probably heard in the media about the Don't Say Gay bill that Governor DeSantis and the legislature passed in Florida, even though the bill, which the Center Square did read, we read the bill from top to bottom, the word gay is not in that bill anywhere. They decided to ban inappropriate curriculum, or curriculum that they deemed inappropriate for young children, kindergarten through three-year-olds, don't need to be having these discussions in the classroom. So they banned it. So when these textbooks came in, these new textbooks came in, the law was already on the books. The state's education department looked through the textbooks and saw that there was things that were banned. There was subject matter that they were talking about that the state of Florida deemed was not appropriate for their school children there, and rejected these percentage of textbooks outright. Now, I can't tell you about the specific publishers. I would not be surprised, if other publishers of these textbooks have also included some of that stuff in their curriculum. But I'm not a subject matter expert on that one, so I can't say specifically for sure.
Well, just the fact that they even tried to sneak these books in and had such a high rate of rejection is just outrageous, because it must just plainly mean it's not appropriate for those ages. Has the cancel culture mob come for you or any of your reporters yet? Like, they've come for my reporter, Jonathan Cho, who covers the homeless of all things, or now Katie Davis Court. Antifa seems to have made reporters. They learn about the enemy.
We thankfully have not had any physical like type of confrontations like that. We do get, you know, we do get unfair, heavy criticism on social media outlets. Twitter even one time, Twitter even suspended our account one time over a Michael Madigan story that we broke, of all things, about government corruption, not even about some of these social issues that are fiery nowadays. So thankfully we've been safe. We do get, you know, we do get emails, and but nothing that I would rise to the level of a significant concern where we need to get the police involved or anything like that.
That's good.
Thankfully,
so, but of cancel course, culture hasn't come for you.
That's not good. not in any grave way.
Okay. So NPR is cutting 10% of its workforce after projecting a $30 million budget shortfall. Facebook, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, which announced Friday it was cutting 12,000 more jobs. NBC, MSNBC, CNN appears to be toast. Is it the advertising model that is dead because of a recession coming, or is it the go woke, go broke phenomena and people got tired of being lied to continuously?
Yeah, I don't see how that second part can't be a big factor into what's going on there. The ratings for all the outlets you mentioned are significantly down. You know, whether you like Fox News or not, their ratings are going the other way. So there's still an appetite for news out there. So I bring it back to the COVID era. It seems like since the COVID era, a lot of these media outlets have either gone way more left or way more right. And I think Americans see right through it nowadays. You could, with social media, with all that's out there, with all the new startups, you know, the Center Square, the company that I work for is new. 4 years ago, the Center Square didn't exist, right? So you couldn't, in the state of Washington or the state of Tennessee, you couldn't come get your state government news from the Center Square. But groups like us that tell the truth and some other outlets are essentially filling the void because I do think some percentage of Americans don't trust many of these outlets, particularly the ones you know, who have gone way left.
That's exactly right. And that's why the Mill Creek View is now the mcview.us website. That's why this podcast is catching fire, because people got tired of watching the talking heads lie to them and wanted to find lovers of truth, which you and I are. Nearly all of the major entertainment giants too, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Disney, Comcast, Roku, are all bracing for sweeping layoffs in the next few weeks. Many of those firms have invested enormously in new streaming products that aren't even profitable yet. Have you forayed into streaming anything?
No, we're not in. We don't do streaming. We're mostly print. We have launched a number of our own podcasts over the past year and a half or so. I record a podcast with our Washington D.C. bureau chief, Casey Harper, who covers all things federal government for us. It's called America in Focus. We do have in the state of Washington, our team there, led by editor Jeremy Lott, records Washington in Focus. That's a weekly podcast. America in Focus is a weekly podcast. And because I'm based in Illinois, and I've been in Illinois for 20 years, now I also record with our editor in Illinois who covers the state capitol for us, Greg Bishop, Illinois in Focus. So we've gotten into the podcast world. We don't have a Tennessee in Focus podcast yet, but
I'll just link this one in. It's good enough. Link it in.
There you go. I'll ask John Stife if he's up for it, though.
Yeah. Well, Gannett, which is USA Today, the largest, the Post, New York Times, all hurting. Digital upstarts like Protocol cut 60. Morning Brew plans to lay off 14%. Outside Media, 15%. Vice Media, 15%. That was Gavin McGinnis's baby once upon a time. They are particularly vulnerable to ad slowdowns, right? So because contracts for digital ads are easier to pull at the last minute than contracts for television ads, is Center Square going to be okay?
Well, I can say since I joined the company in 2017, we've grown every single year. We've added staff every single year. In 2017, when I joined the company, we were in Illinois only. We slowly grew to where we're covering all 50 states. This year alone, it's middle of February, right? We hired a new journalist in the state of Pennsylvania and a new journalist in the state of Washington. We have plans to add four or five more journalists this year. So you never know what the future holds. But we've only grown since I've started here, and I only expect that to continue.
Congratulations. You know, and just to put a capper on it, companies like Substack scrapped their plans to raise money this year due to the brutal economic environment. But it's not all bad. News Corp revenue rose to a record $10.4 billion last year. I could only dream of that. We know that about the pro-Trump factor, that when he was gone, a lot of this washed out. He even guaranteed that some of the left-leaning media would suffer without him, and they have. The U.S. pay TV, cable, and satellite market is now shrinking by more than 6% per year, setting a new record for the worst level of decline. But anyway, I only got about 5 minutes left with you, so I want to talk about this real quick. The Supreme Court is looking at Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Justice Elena Kagan said, these are not like the nine greatest experts on the internet. The justices wondered whether YouTube should lose immunity if the algorithms that provide recommendations are neutral or used to organize content based on users' interest, so they hold the fate in their hands but don't know what they're doing, the Supreme Court, that is. What do you think of 230? Will it matter? And I guess the justices will hear also arguments in a related case over whether Twitter can be held liable under the Anti-Terrorism Act for aiding and abetting an act of international terrorism by allegedly failing to adequately screen its platform for the presence of militant groups. At the same time, Swedish telecom company Ericsson sued by U.S. terror victims over alleged Iraq bribe payments. Hundreds alleged company paid protection money to terror groups. What do you make of all this tech and terror nexus?
Well, it's kind of scary, particularly when the tech and some of these social media companies are blocking, you know, Americans from speaking their minds about something like COVID. Now, all that said, obviously it's a concerning if social media companies, et cetera, are giving a voice to terrorist organizations. That's concerning. I generally err.
Money too.
Exactly. I generally err on the side of the First Amendment. I am a big First Amendment supporter. The censorship with government teaming up with the Biden administration, you know, essentially having open communications with Twitter and Facebook and the other outlets about censoring American speech, that is 100% wrong. I think it's a little bit murkier here when you're talking about private businesses. I would think for their own sake, Twitter wouldn't want to be promoting, you know, terrorist organizations in the Middle Sea or overseas in the Middle East. I would think that would hurt them as a company and hurt their brand and hurt them financially. I am generally, though, as a First Amendment advocate, private businesses can control their own speech.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. I so very much appreciate it. We're nearing the end here. Please tell our listeners what we can expect from for the future of Center Square, where they can go to find out more about you and Center Square.
TheCenterSquare.com. Depending on where you live, where you're listening to this from, we make it easy for our readers. If you're only interested in Tennessee news, we have a state drop-down page. You just go to the Tennessee page, bookmark it, same with the state of Washington or whatever state you're in. We have a national section where, as I mentioned, Casey Harper, our D.C. reporter, covers the federal government. We cover all 50 states, so depending on what you're interested in, you can get all kinds of news. We publish about 75 or so stories every single day, so there's plenty out there. And as I mentioned up front, we cover news from a taxpayer's perspective. We want our readers to know, here's how government operates and spends your money. It's not government's money, it's taxpayers' money.
Excellent. Thanks again for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Loved it.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on our minds today. Producer Steve, what did you think of Dan McCaleb and Center Square?
Well, I love the whole aspect of what he's doing, and the fact that you told me off air how you met, and that now you're able to use some of his materials, or I should say their reporters. And I love that because it adds that reporter aspect to your publication, which really bolsters what you're doing there, Steve. And the fact is, yeah, Chicago has been known as a criminal syndicate-run city since, I mean, they've got movies about that stuff since the 30s, the 20s.
Yeah.
I mean, that's things.
Yeah.
And then it was interesting about the Pitzker family. I was going to look up Bad Blood by Bad Blood, and then we could have put a little piece in there for that gal, that he, she, that you're talking about. But Pritzkers, man, how many big families that are billionaires use that money for evil and not for good?
Too many. Going all the way back to the Rockefellers and the Carnegies.
That's right.
Well, yes, real quick, I did tell you off air that I sat down for coffee with Dan back when I first took over the Mill Creek View, and had gotten in touch with him through his reporter, Brett Davis, who covers Washington State. When I asked Brett if I could use his article for reprint, he submitted it, let me do that, and sent me to Dan. Dan came and met me one-on-one, and he's been a great, great supporter of the Mill Creek View ever since. And so I was thrilled to bring him on and tell everybody about thecentersquare.com. Make sure you put the on there. Well, Steve, what a week. We had four shows instead of regular scheduled three. Remember Saturday, get out there and see hear Kurt Cameron read his children's book at the library in Nashville. Remember when it was once every other week and I read the Mill Creek View newspaper for half of it and what it's become now? Seems like 10 years ago, but nope. Today is the 1 year anniversary of when Fred Philbrook, the founder of the Mill Creek View hometown newspaper since 1991, passed away. And this whole media group fell onto my lap. Time sure flies, doesn't it? Fred's 86th birthday would have been February 10th. We're both Aquariuses. It's about all we had in common. He's with Jesus now, so God bless him. And thank you, Fred. You changed my whole life in more ways than just this show. Okay, so they said COVID gives kids more myocarditis. That COVID does. Science and our health authorities told us that myocarditis is much more frequent from COVID than from vaccinations, by Igor Chudov, dailyclout.io. A new study from Scandinavian countries is out. The author worked for health departments of the four Nordic countries.
Of course.
They were tasked with looking at their entire populations and their computerized records, seeking out instances of myocarditis. They had vaccination records for all people as well. It turned out that in their countries, 530 people had myocarditis from the vaccine, 109 had myocarditis from COVID-19. As far as deaths go, 27 persons died from vaccine myocarditis, 18 died from COVID-related myocarditis. So please tell me, how could it be true that COVID causes more myocarditis?
It's not, and I would even... you and I know we've done enough research, Steve. I would even suspect that those numbers are totally off the charts because they're not. Steve, the number one thing that kills people in the United States, either cancer or heart attacks, it's been that way for the last 30 years. So they can just lump anybody that had a heart attack and say they had COVID, and now they get to add that in there. But the people that are the sudden death syndrome that's going on, that's brand new, and they cannot account for that because it's among young people.
And if you had said that on YouTube last year, you would have been banned and the show would not be airing right now. Let's play clip number one.
If we're going to take the good parts of that and move it forward, we're going to do it interdependent. Take the good part.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to get this set up. Hold on. They don't want me to do that. Come on. There we go.
Now, I think there's only two categories. There are those that once the FDA gives full approval, will go forward with it, and that there are those who have become entrenched in a kind of radical libertarianism and an identity of politic that has sort of perversely turned this issue into something that forgets that in the United States of America, in our entire history, it's all based on being independent because we understand interdependency, the entire history of successful things in this country. And if we're going to continue with successful things, if we're going to take some of the great lessons that have been learned in the last year, some of the extraordinary movements, you look at George Floyd, all of what's happening societally, if we're going to take the good parts of that and move it forward, we're going to do it interdependently. And I think vaccination is the beginning of that, given that it's such a threat now to business, to lifestyle, to life here and around the world.
I mean, I'm a great respecter of individual liberties. I respect the Gadsden flag. But this is not a seatbelt. You know, if you choose not to wear a seatbelt, I wish you'd wear a seatbelt. You're going to add to my insurance premiums if you get effed up in an accident.
Right.
But this is different. This is you running the risk of contaminating everybody else in society.
It's, you know, I have some areas of strong belief in the Second Amendment. But I think that you need to recognize how, you know, with something like this, you can't go around pointing a gun in somebody's face, which is.
Just want to.
Sean Penn, ladies and gentlemen, Sean Penn. People who are unvaccinated need to realize that resisting getting the shot is not a sign of independence. Rather, it's an opposition to the kind of interdependence that has made the country successful. Back to the article. Several known facts make the picture even worse than the article presents. Numerous myocarditis cases caused by vaccines result in sudden death and not hospitalizations. The University of Heidelberg study shows that 20% of sudden post-vaccination deaths that they autopsied are due to myocarditis. Let me just read from table one here. Characteristics of 7,292 individuals with new onset myocarditis in Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. Age group, 12 to 24, 202 vaccinated, 19 COVID-19. 25 to 39, 138 vaccinated, 29 COVID-19. 40 and above, 190 vaccinated, 61 COVID. The most important addition, brought up thanks to Peter Kust comments, is that the vaccine caused myocarditis was all for nothing. The vaccine ended up not preventing COVID-19. First, someone would get vaccinated, then vaccine myocarditis might follow, then they would get COVID, and more myocarditis could occur. That's a bad deal. Some people trying to debunk this story may ask, what about the background rate of myocarditis? What if the persons listed in the above study as having vaccine myocarditis actually had it for unrelated reasons? It's not a bad question and needs to be explored. My answer to those objections is that approximately the same number of people had COVID by the time the study period ended in 2022, as was the number of vaccinated people. So the exposures to vaccines and COVID are roughly equal. And yet the incidence of myocarditis after vaccine is about 5 times greater than after COVID. Let's hear clip number 2.
People in communities, leaders in various communities to come on board, that's particularly important with the vaccine. I mean, even when the vaccine is more widely available, there are a lot of people who are going to be hesitant to take it. I think maybe a lot of that may begin to kind of thaw out as, you know, more people see images of people getting the vaccine. But it's still, for a lot of people, going to be a hard sell. I talked to Bill Gates about this a number of times, who obviously has a huge amount of experience, you know, with polio vaccines and others, trying to reach out to communities where there's a lot of suspicion. I'm wondering how you think you can be a part of sort of changing that attitude, that hesitancy.
Well, I think transparency is a really important thing. And I think it's a two-way street. For example, if I have hesitation about getting a vaccine, I don't. I happen to, for whatever reason, and frankly, that's it. For whatever reason, my best instincts about the scientists that I'm listening to tell me I would get the vaccine yesterday, as soon as I came onto the criteria. But I do understand people having concerns about this, but what those people also have to have communicated to them is they have to look at their lifestyle and what people they're going to come in contact with. For example, we all know that younger people seem to be less seriously affected by the COVID virus than older people. That said, are you connecting with people? Are you being diligent with masking and distancing and hand washing? What kind of job do you have that puts you in touch with whom? All of those things have to be considered while people are allowed to go through whatever process they need to go through. You know, with the masking and the distancing, I have personally very little tolerance with those who don't exercise that common sense courtesy of public health to others. When it comes to the vaccine, I think we have to be very careful about how we talk about it. The kind of classic anti-vax movement are just scientific ignoramuses. But when it comes to a brand new vaccine, you know, as a skeptical mind is as healthy as one that's ready to go, like I'm ready to go. And we have to respect it, and we have to talk with respect about that. But that also has to be very, very considered when it comes to how much you're able and willing to limit your exposure to others.
Huh. Kind of a little different tune than his first one, huh?
Yeah, that was Sean Penn again. And this from Lucia Sinatra in the New York Post, co-founded No College Mandates to Put an End to College Vaccine Mandates. This article, headlines last week, declared natural immunity better protection than vaccines based on a Lancet study Thursday that backed up a groundbreaking Israeli study from August 2021. Yet vaccine mandates continue to block a full return to normalcy, and it's taken a particularly hard toll on college kids. 3 years in, and well after COVID ceased to be a deadly nationwide threat, many institutions are still reluctant to let go of pandemic restrictions. Parents have come to see how those lingering rules have hit the young especially hard. For college students, campuses feel forever altered under the weight of the ubiquitous refrain to keep the community safe, unquote. Some professors, for instance, still mask their classes or move them online. Many colleges continue to have vaccine and booster mandates in place. Of all the lessons from the pandemic, the greatest is how fragile our civil liberties are. We have witnessed a relentless encroachment on every civil liberty we've ever taken for granted, up to and including the right to education and bodily autonomy to breathe. Even with the pandemic clearly over, the FDA continues to issue emergency use authorization for COVID-19 vaccines and tests. We have no idea what any of this means for college mandates, but we do know that after 3 long years, we have had enough. Students and parents will no longer be silenced if college bureaucrats aren't willing to end their reckless and outdated COVID-19 policies now. Parents will shift their support to colleges that do. But alas, the CDC quietly added the COVID shots to the child immunization schedule last week. So by placing the vaccine on the child immunization schedule, they will enjoy complete indemnity forever, pursuant to the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. Clip number 3, please.
Oh, you should be coming on pretty soon, dude. How much do you smoke?
This will be a little demonstration of that. Listen up. That was my skull. I'm so wasted.
Yeah.
That's the Sean Penn we know and love. Let's finish out the busy week, 4 shows in 1 week, 2 in 1 day, on this. Clip number 4.
Has put solidarity ahead of his own personal safety. Air raid sirens and no real guarantee of security.
As air raid sirens blared, so was incredibly dramatic, Andrea. It was historic as well.
Historic, timely, and brave.
The first American president to go to a war zone with no U.S. military presence for security on the ground.
American presidents have made dramatic trips before. Caribbean. Nixon to China, Kennedy, Reagan to the Berlin Wall, and presidents have visited U.S. troops in war zones, but never like this.
To find a day of this kind of presidential bravery in a war zone, you've got to go all the way back to 1864.
Caribbean. With Biden's trip to Europe, you know, he is welcomed as not only the savior of Ukraine, but also the savior of Europe as a whole.
It's historic. It's the first time that a U.S. president has gone into an active war zone that Gravy the U.S. military does not have control over.
And against all odds, it was successful.
The continuing threat, quite literally sounding all around the two leaders.
The skies here are not safe. And in fact, an air raid siren went Gravy off while President Biden was here.
Seeing the American president there, walking the streets of Kyiv while air raid sirens literally sounded in that moment.
Oh my God.
About possible incoming fire from
it's
Russia.
A production.
The wail of an air raid siren.
Air raid sirens wailing fake in the background. Sirens.
Seemingly undeterred by an air raid siren.
Undeterred by the sound of air sirens.
President Biden's ability with his aviators on to walk through in broad Gravy daylight in Kyiv.
The swagger of this trip. Not just the execution of the secrecy, but the swagger of it on display on the streets of Kyiv.
The swagger, Steve. That is such a produced, you got Biden walking around. The fact is, it's all fake. Every bit of it's a fake
thing. No, Steve. Biden is the best, bravest ever. Patton and Caesar and Top Gun and aviators all combined. But Steve, do you think the Secret Service would allow a president to go outside in an air raid if an air raid was really happening?
Of course not. Not one bit.
They lie about everything.
Everything.
Stay tuned for my thought of the week. And just like the staging of the Ukraine air raid, I knew when they let an experimental vaccine be used on a president of the United States in his 80s, it was all a joke. And welcome to my thought of the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify, iTunes, and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost. Thomas Jefferson. Whoever would overthrow the liberty of a nation must begin by subduing the freeness of speech. Benjamin Franklin, who was not a president. No experiment can be more interesting than that we are now trying, and which we trust will end in establishing the fact that man may be governed by reason and truth. Our first object should therefore be to leave open to him all the avenues to truth. The most effectual hitherto found is the freedom of the press. It is therefore the first shut up by those who fear the investigation of their actions. Also Thomas Jefferson. Freedom of the press, if it means anything at all, means the freedom to criticize and oppose. George Orwell, author of 1984. Freedom of the press is not just important to democracy, it is democracy. Walter Cronkite. Well, that's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Dan McCaleb of Center Square, for keeping the news true and honest with an eye on our money. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper, with one out today at millcreekviewonline.com. Check it out and subscribe to the e-newsletter at mcview.us. Just enter your email address. Peace in our time.
In the air, laughter of the children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.